The version you saw is a transfer of a transfer of a transfer. That version actually came from a DVD, and then Rock subtitled it. The actual 8mm of it is missing in Bangkok. It was sent there 2 years ago for restoration, and the lab closed, and there were two films sent there. One returned sa Maynila, which you'll see actually tomorrow, and Tranong Puti is missing.
I'm glad that it is missing.
It has an interesting group of people who worked on it. I think one of the better known ones is this guy, Dante Mendoza, known as
Brillante Mendoza.
Brillante Mendoza. He's been to Cannes a few times and the Berlinale.
Okay.
And then you have The Great Smoke. We managed to track down the original Super 8. It's in the Philippines. This is a scan that we recently did, but we scanned the audio, and it's like a lot of the issues with Super 8, it's really bad. The audio really tends to go first. And so we're trying to look for ways to still restore the audio. Kalamay, we found in the Arsenal vaults. Thanks again for letting us screen it. And the sound has pretty much...
Yeah, now destroyed. No? Oh.
So this was done in collaboration with one of Rox's frequent collaborators at Makulangan, one of the guys crawling around in the film being looped in the exhibition, Juan Gapang, Johnny Crawl. He's now a very respected photographer. Lizard was actually made in Super 8 and then blown up to 16mm in one of the Goethe Institute workshops during Ingo Pechke workshop. Spit optic, I don't really understand.
Yeah, I told me that that film should not be included anymore because...
So it was actually, I tracked down some catalogs, and in the same year it was shown as one film, and in another catalog the same year it was shown as two films. And somewhere along the line it got combined, I don't know, and it looked like that. But part of the film was done in a workshop with Christoph Janetzko, who you'll meet tomorrow. And Moron's Monologue, it was also a collaborative film done by the same people who did Juan Gapang or Johnny Crawl.
Yeah, that movie was shot in Super 8. We use expired films.
Mm-hmm.
So
again, this is a film with terrible sound issues.
Yeah, the sound
but,
is
but
I want to edit that movie again.
Yeah. So Rox has been lobbying the Arsenal to give him digital files of Kalamay, Lizard, Spit Optic, and Moron's Monologue so he can re-edit them. And then lastly, Harajuku. What you saw is a digital file. It's the only components that we have left. I saw catalog accounts of this, that it was actually a bit longer, but these are digital files that survived, and this is what found itself to us. It's currently missing. It was shot in 16mm. It was first, it premiered in Yamagata International Documentary Festival in 1992. And it was because Rox's career was supported by the Axis powers, Germany and Japan. So, 92 onwards, it was all Japan.
Yeah.
So, thanks again for letting us show these stuff here. And to David and Hakavetu, allowing us to fool around. But let's open the floor for questions.
Okay. Hi.
No questions?
Thanks, to you both. I just want to raise something that, I mean, it's a half thought. I recently saw that a big chunk of Documenta, the current Documenta exhibition, takes composition and scoring as a central motif, the score, and the idea of a musical score or a musical composition as a format that can be unpacked for the purposes of other art forms, and indeed for teaching, for pedagogy and for practice and training. And I just wanted to invite you to talk a little about spontaneity, about how important the spontaneous is, Rox, in your work, and Merv, perhaps in Philippines experimental practice more broadly. It occurred to me watching Harajuku that we see performances in public spaces, and this is something that is clearly very important in Rox's work, the sight of the public. So One Gapang, the film that Merv just mentioned, is on show looped in the exhibition Misfits. Hanging out a little bit with Rox here in Berlin, it immediately occurred to me that this is someone who sees public space as a kind of stage, space for constant intervention and improvisation and engagement with the public. So I thought I would just ask you to reflect a little on that, perhaps the spontaneous versus the...
Yes, in addition to that, David, because I really like the street sceneries and street performances, so as of now, we have this kind of street cinema in which we screen the movies along the roads or in the barrios in the provinces. So we go around the Philippines and screening some of the works of the filmmakers. So it's for free, we screen it in public. So street cinema and street performers.
Well, with regards to spontaneity, I think there's a heavy dose of that especially in the 80s. And it was not restricted to moving image work, but also like the budding experimental media scene, noise. I think it was a reaction against structure and the collapsing structures of society at that time. There was a very strong punk and DIY scene that Rox kind of found himself in and became like an icon of.
And it was during the Marcos regime and the EDSA revolution by that time.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow the filmmakers of those times are affected in mm-hmm. some ways.
And so there's a bit of a rebellion there against structure.
Yes, yeah.
And you could see still bits of it going through younger practitioners and practitioners who went through Moelfand and Roxley and formed their own like communities, like artist-run communities in the mid-90s and even now.
Yeah.
So, did that answer your question?
Yeah, and Rox, could you say a little about your time in Japan? Because it seems to me that the sort of performance that you're filming in Harajuku, of course, it's public. It may or may not be rehearsed, but this Japanese mode of public performance seems very scripted in a way. I wonder how you felt about that.
Maybe some of them were scripted, but when we shot this Harajuku movie, the performers, the musicians are just doing their own things. So they play music and they perform. They are not for the money, but they just want to entertain the public. So I think I find them interesting because, for example, in the Philippines, the performers are performing for the money, and usually we don't find them in the streets. So they are in some bars or in some close places. But I'm very interested in this kind of performing because it is very entertaining to the public.
I just have to add that since we got to Berlin, like, Rox has been so excited about going to see the Berlin Wall and tagging it again because he, when he was here, he was like, oh, he tagged the Berlin Wall in 89 and saw it collapse. And he wanted to do it that again. And then while we were walking to random places, whenever he spots a street musician, he kind of wants to jam along.
Yeah, well, I found...
So there's a lot of spontaneity and weirdness there.
But in this case, the street musicians I found in the subways, usually they are not Germans, but foreigners. So maybe someday I find some other performers there.
Maybe you will, no?
Yeah, if I want to make another movie and I have no budget, maybe you can find me in the subway to raising money. Because usually we do our own films. We subsidize our movies because I seldom got grants or funding from other sources. So you can see some of those not very refined movies that I made. The Super 8 films, they are not well funded, and so you can see the result.
Some of them were actually shot on expired stock.
Yeah, for example, the Moron's Monologue, we shot it on expired Super 8 films. And the result is horrible. Ah, here's Christoph Janetsko. Christoph.
Hey.
Yeah, you want to say something? Because Christoph Janetsko is our mentor during the workshop, the 16 millimeter. But maybe you can... Oh, okay.
I have, thank you so much for coming. Also, I want to ask Merv when, I think first the relationship towards materiality, so why does the films or like the material are getting lost? And when did your collaboration started? And when did you, Merv, had this interest to make this huge archive in his works?
Because I think, especially for celluloid, a lot of people forget and that, you know, the moving image is very physical. And a lot of that physical element is getting lost. It's deteriorating. Rox's house was flooded in 2009.
Yeah,
and a lot of material, like a lot of works on paper, and a lot of celluloid were you know, literally washed away. So it's great that these material found themselves in places like Tokyo or Berlin, and were maybe like other places that they were screened. We don't know why they stayed here. We're still trying to find out. But we know, like, I think it's great that, like, you know, copies have been kept in different places. So even though, like, for example, Rox is a very local, like, icon, tracing his history is far from, you know, parochial. As for why and when, I think I work a lot with another artist, Shireen Seno, and we started putting together a screening program that accidentally became an archival project. It's called the Kalampag Tracking Agency. Kalampag means like a noise, yeah. Like something's broken, like a rattling. Tracking agency, because basically that's what we became. Like, it's a lot of investigative work, a lot of driving, and Kalampag is like, you know, you hear it and you think something's wrong. It's like, but sometimes it's like, what's wrong that actually comforts you? And like, these are, it's a collection of works that rattled the engine of commercial cinema at some point, or film, or art history. And because we're so conscious about keeping films and moving image works in their original formats, or like the formats they've been in, and looking for material evidence, we found ourselves collecting a small treasure trove of material that we keep in our houses, which also function as artist-run centers in the Philippines. So it's very ad hoc and very community-oriented and very non-institutional. And there's no funding, and we do it in our spare time.
But there's no Sophia in the Philippines, the one preserving the movies, the film?
Actually, no. Because they're more of an activist organization.
Yeah, okay.
So the physical archives are actually in different places, like in ABS-CBN archive, and in, like, now we're collaborating a lot with the National Film Archive of the Philippines, and actually in the Asian Film Archive in Singapore for the preservation of some of the celluloid. And we're actively scanning and tracking down information. So yeah, it's a long, ongoing process. Yes. He wants to go first. Would you like to go first?
No,
sorry. Hey.
Thank you so much for this opportunity to a precious opportunity to see a series of films of tonight. I'm actually very intrigued by Split Optics, the work that was least kind of explained in more of your introduction or commentary. It seems like there are two types of materials that were compiled. One is moving image, a negative, and the other one is still photographs. Mm. It seems to me that the little exposure that I've been given to your work, Rox, the beauty of animated film or the comic strips figures is there's a degree of abstraction and also kind of removal of individual identity, yet ability for the viewers to somehow relate to the figures through their rhythms of movement. And I was struck by this one still photographic image where the individuals, the area around their eyes are blocked. I'm wondering about how you kind of played within that particular film, Split and Optics, the highly individualized portrait of a man and also the female nudes whose identities are not revealed, and this kind of criminal-like photograph.
I don't even understand those images.
Where did you find them?
Where did you find them?
It's because it's a group work, and maybe they found them, and so we just collaborated. And so this is the kind of work that it looks like we are just playing on the effects, on the optical printing effects. So I still want to edit it because that's why I'm telling her to. And that's a bad idea, because when you make a film, once you finish the film, you should stick to it, but...
Actually, you've been constantly re-editing your work since... I don't think you stopped, though.
Oh, yeah, seriously.
So the latter part of the optic, no? The spit part was supposedly the animation part, the man with no brain. And then the latter part, it was, like he said, a group work.
Yeah, it's a group.
And it was done during like one of Christoph Janetsko's workshops.
Optical.
I think the first one in 1988. As for the archival material, I think I don't really know where they came from. I know that some of the material came from a waste bin.
And yeah, the wasted outtakes, 35 millimeter films. So we got them from the trash can and we reshoot them with the optical printing. So it's a found footages.
I don't really understand the choices, but I do understand like the background of some of the individuals who chose them, because that was a time when certain, like, you know, there's a lot of nostalgia and romanticism for the indigenous Filipino. So a lot of research actually was into that. Some people were getting into ethnomusicology and like and research into these anthropological stuff, material, and that was somehow kind of incorporated into the soundtrack, into the visuals. I'm not sure how intentional they are or how thought out they are. It's very freeform. It's very Dada. So.
Very Dada.
Dada.
What is Dada?
Okay. You are Dada. I'm sorry if I didn't answer your question well, but Lani? Lani has a question.
I don't really have a question.
Lani is a Filipino from...
Filipino from Canada, from France.
From France.
Yeah.
She's staying in France.
I want to thank you for showing these films. I'm so embarrassed because I've never seen them before. So I'm really happy.
Because we are not showing this.
He just saw them again.
We're deciding the films for years.
Well, I just wanted to say, maybe because I came from the same generation or a little bit later, I could really identify most of these things, not as a narrative, but as an atmosphere or as a time and place. So I will just respond to the last question. I think it's a lot of what you're doing is a resistance to any kind of mastery or masterful filmmaking. Of course, a resistance to master narratives. And I feel just from, I guess, somebody who was at that time and space when you were making these films, I really like the abstraction that happens when you make the collages, because the reality as they were when you use images of the Vietnam War or other atrocities, or even the stuff that happened in the Philippines, they were real events, but they were also abstracted in a way, because it's so hard to deal with the representation of this kind of realities. And I think in the film, I felt that so well in terms of how we experience that, those kinds of mediated images, but at the same time, what happens to us emotionally, psychologically, within those spaces when we experience or see those things directly, but also how we live them in our everyday lives in situations of poverty or impoverished situations when we create works of art or other creative things. So it's just a personal response that I feel, I'm so happy to see them. And I feel,
Maybe maybe you are happy tonight, but maybe tomorrow you will be greater.
Well, that's another story. That's another day. Thanks a lot.
I think, yes, May has a question.
By the way, for your information, with this pen, Lizard, I didn't give any credit to the musician. It was the musician is Nena Hagen. She's German, so I should have put some credits, but maybe later on.
When you edit it again.
Yes, yes.
Yes, me.
Thank you, Roxenberg. That was a great program. I felt there was a lot of variety, and certainly Kalamai for me was a sort of surprising introduction to the other kind of montage work that you do. I just wondered if you could talk about the relationship in terms of your process between the work in this program and your drawings, animation in the exhibition. I mean, how do you see the two relating to each other? And particularly around, you cut so well, the rhythm of your montage is so incredibly precise. I don't think you need to recut. So I wonder whether that comes out of any kind of a relationship between the drawings.
But maybe there is no relationship. It's another drawings. But somehow I started making some cartoons, so I tried to make it like an animated movement. So maybe that's the one I integrated. Somehow, maybe. Maybe if it comes to animation, maybe. But the movement is like a very fast movement, so maybe it's like an animation in live form. It's hard to understand.
You're starting to understand.
No, it's very hard to relate. But anyway, that's somehow I tried to connect.
Julian.
Thanks for the screening. My question is sort of related, but I was wondering how these films were like screened. Were they screened outside of the workshops in which they were made? And can you elaborate a little more on like your involvement in the punk scene? Because many of these films, I see they're collaborative works, and I would just like to hear you talk a little more about your involvement in the punk scene that I think Merv sort of suggested moments ago. Thank you.
I was not really involved with the punk scene. I just observed them, but sometimes maybe I attended some concerts like that. So somehow I identified with them. So I tried to put some images.
I think the punk scene absorbed rocks.
I don't know.
Yeah, but they were like rocks was punk before.
No. I think because my brother is the one who is punk, so maybe I got something from him. Somehow like that.
Where were they screened rocks?
Yung
films where. San Rosila na screen.
Usually they were screened in some small venues, so small audience. This is bigger enough because usually when we screen the Philippines, it's only me and the projectionist. So I'm very happy that this is a very good number of audience.
Lani and Rox were talking a while ago over lunch, and they were talking about Pinaglabanan galleries. which was an artist initiated a gallery. Agnes Arellano and Michael Adams.
Yes.
And that was one of the venues that the films were being screened in. I actually have like a flyer catalog that we digitized some time ago. And I think in the exhibition you'd notice that some of the fanzines, the punk scenes, they'd mention like the schedule of gigs, and in between the gigs, there's like mobile fun, experimental Super 8 films. So they were also screened in like rock, underground rock venues, and in punk gigs. A lot of the people involved in the punk scene would gravitate to rocks, and then some of them would later start their own, like, not necessarily punk, not necessarily experimental film projects, but create, I guess, new forms, what some people would now call media art.
Yes.
Or, yeah.
And some of them are now making money, no?
But not you, no.
Not me.
And then I think in the 90s and early 2000s, when there's more artist-run spaces, then they were screened in artist-run spaces. And actually, yeah, Rox was saying like he had shows in Hiraya and Pinaglabanan, and then I think later on, it was during the, I guess, the heyday of the artist-run communities in the late 90s and early 2000s in the Philippines. So those were the venues. If we weren't pirating them, no. And passing each other tips. Any more questions? Oh, ma'am. Oh, Mike. Okay. You'll be the last question. I was informed we're running out of time.
No pressure. I wonder then how these works came to be supported by institutions like the Goethe Institute and the Japan Foundation. How that, how Rox, I guess, made that transition, if you like, from these underground spaces and then, taken overseas, and maybe how the works were then presented and received outside of the Philippines.
Christoph, this is the question Christoph. For you.
Yes, can you answer that, Christoph? Because he's involved.
He's partly responsible for migrating these films to Germany.
I can try to answer that. I'm not a representative from the Goethe Institute, but...
But they used you.
They used me, yes. They didn't abuse me, but used me. And anyway, it was a time in the 80s and till the early 90s where it was West Germany, and where the Goethe Institute has actually a lot of money. And they had distributed programs all over the world, collector provinces, especially Uwe Schmelter, who was very dedicated to film. And he was collecting also, he was putting programs together, sending around also by Rosa von Praunheim. I mean, there were a lot of also, I must say, gay and lesbian films in that time. And after, and it was always a political issue until the early 90s that then the conservative government just cut down the budget for the Goethe Institute 80% for film production, because they didn't like the programs they were doing and sending around, because they said it's not representative for the German cultures. They wanted to have, you know, the cows in Bavaria and whatever. That's what they like to. So it was in the 80s, there was a lot of money for this kind of workshops, which is non-existing anymore. It stopped in the early 90s, I can't say 92 or 93 or something. Uwe Schmelter would have been a better person to answer that. But and there was a lot of, there were budgets to produce this kind of workshops because this were all made in analog films, and it was not cheap to buy negatives, to have them processed, and to have to make to have the copy mates. So that was the time where we were all very lucky that there were budgets for this kind of films. But also this was a time where experimental film was at the peak in the 80s also, which is not the same actually today. And in the 80s, so I remember when I did my very first workshop with the Goethe Institute, that was the workshop where Split and Optics also had been made. The Berlin Film Festival was, International Berlin Film Festival was surprised about the films, and they invited the films for the International Film Festival. And then the Goethe Institute, of course, supported a lot of showing, sending the films around the world, not only to Germany, to Japan, to international film festivals, but that was basically a lucky time that the economical situation was like that, that the interest was that. And I must say, it had been definitely a political decision to change that.
And to add also, in the 80s, because so a lot of the material, the actual film stock were actually like remnants of these workshops. Some were not produced during the workshops, but after or between workshops, utilizing available resources, like or making taking advantage of the fact that the mobile fund is there, equipment is there, they could do stuff well. It was like a halfway house for artists, and they just took advantage of the material availability. And then another factor also, in the 80s, there was this quest for Asian identity in manifesting in these festivals. So Yamagata was really conscious about creating the Asian documentary aesthetic, and Rox is one of the signers of the manifesto. And then festivals like in Hong Kong were starting up, and Singapore, and they were actively like going through the all possible channels. They had budget. They were able to hang out with artists. So they were patient enough and crazy enough and young enough to be part of communities. And that's how these films, I guess, like made themselves into international venues, especially in Asia and Germany. And yes, we have to end now, but you'll hear more from Christoph tomorrow. He's going to be presenting the second part of the program with Roxy, and it's going to be Rox's friends, and Rox is doing an animation workshop tomorrow, and that will be the first part of the program. Thank you very much.
God bless you all.